So we're at the start of a new series looking at the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah. And last week we were thinking about his call as a prophet, and now thinking about his message, the content of what he came to say. Now he was in a time of decline in God's people, and he was preaching an unpopular message. He's quite well known for being the crying prophet, if you like. But actually, really, he was just saying the reality of the world around the people he was speaking to. And that was that God wasn't pleased with the nation because Israel was compromising politically with the huge empires around them, and more importantly, was compromising spiritually with the nations which it lived side by side. And at the time of Jeremiah, there were two kinds of prophets. On the one hand, there were those who told the people everything they wanted to hear. Everything's great, everything's fine, we're going to be fine. We're going to just live in peace and prosperity for as long as we possibly can. And then on the other hand, there was Jeremiah, a team of one, bringing a very different message, the summary of which we heard read to us by Jeremy just now. In our reading, we heard two things that God said through the prophet Jeremiah. And that was God was reminding the people of the golden age, if you like, of Israel, when they loved God, they trusted him. This was during and just after the events of the Exodus that God's referring to, when he rescued them from slavery by protecting them from the terrible plagues that he sent on Egypt at the Passover, and when he brought them through and out of slavery through the Red Sea. And back then, the people recognized the awesomeness of God's salvation. They loved him. They trusted him. Just like a newly married bride would her husband. That's why God says that you were like a bride and I was like your husband. They trusted God as he led them on the start of their journey through the promised land. But then things started to go wrong. The people began to grumble against God. They mistrusted the fact that he had brought them out of Egypt. If you know Exodus, they started to think maybe life was even better being slaves in Egypt. And even when they reached the promised land, the majority of the people didn't believe in that promise. They didn't want to go in. They said, oh, the people, they look a bit strong. They look a bit angry. We can't possibly defeat them in battle. We don't believe what God told us. And even when God had given them success in battle against their enemies, even after he had settled them peaceably in the land, they turned away from him to the idols of the nations around them. And we hear the exasperation in God's voice in verse 5. What fault did your fathers find in me that they strayed so far from me? In other words, God is saying, of all the nations of the world, you are the smallest, the most insignificant, but I chose you and I saved you and I brought you into a wonderful land and I protected you and gave you victory over your enemies. And how have you paid me back? By worshipping other gods. And verse 13, at the end of the reading, wonderfully summarizes what's gone wrong. It says this: my people have committed two sins. They have forsaken me, the spring of living water, and have dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that cannot hold water. In other words, God's people have not only abandoned him, they've even tried to replace him with counterfeit gods. And that, in fact, is the name of this wonderful book that I brought with me today, Counterfeit Gods. It's by the great Christian preacher and writer Tim Keller, which a couple of you may have heard of. He passed away just this last year. And in it, Keller argues that we, in our age, are not prone to bowing down to idols made of wood, you know, shaped out of metal or of stone. But rather, the idols we're more inclined to worship are much more subtle. And the subtitle of the book at the bottom there, you probably can't read it, but it says, when the empty promises of love, money and power let you down. Why, asks Tim Keller, is the first commandment of the ten, thou shalt have no other gods before me? In other words, why is the first of all the commandments the one which prohibits idolatry, the worshipping of idols? And Tim Keller says, because all sin is essentially idolatry. All sin is making something which isn't God more important than God, making a mini idol, if you like, out of it. And the most powerful idols are the most attractive, the most subtle. But Keller reminds us that these idols will only ever let you down. And verse 13 tells us that in a vivid picture. It says, you've dug your own cisterns, your own wells, but they're broken. They can't hold water. You pour stuff into them, it'll just go straight back out again. That's a picture of false gods, of idols. Effort, worship, love, devotion is poured into them, but it all just leaks out again. They can't live up to God. They simply can't do what he can do. Just like a fake bridge can't hold your weight when you try to walk across it. Fake things just can't do the job of the real thing. And so in the book, Tim Keller tries to encourage each Christian to think, what are the subtle idols that we in our day are likely to make more important than God, but not even notice? And he has a little diagnostic. He says that most basic question which God poses to each human heart is this: has something or someone besides Jesus Christ taken title to your heart's functional trust, preoccupation, loyalty, service, fear, and delight? Questions bring some of people's idol systems to the surface, like this: to who or what do you look for life-sustaining stability, for security, for acceptance? What deep down do you really want and expect out of life? What would really make you happy? What would make you an acceptable person? Where do you look for power and success? These questions or similar ones tease out whether we serve God or idols, whether we look for salvation from Christ or from false saviours. But remember, relying on broken systems was only one part of a two-part problem, God says. The first issue was that Israel had forsaken God, the real source of life-giving water, that cistern that will never let us down. In Jeremiah's time, he was not a very successful prophet. He preached for years and years to the people, and how many converts did he get in all that time? Probably only one or two. Because all the people who listened to his message, their reaction was always the same. They said, oh, come off it, you old killjoy. Why are you making such a fuss? And the fact is that there was no motivation for the people at the time to identify their idolatry, let alone turn away from it. And I can only think that's because they had never really tasted the living water of God in the first place. Nobody who had really done so could be so apathetic. It's like saying to someone, well, tell me about your first love. Tell me about the first time you were really in love with someone. And then they say to you, well, it was pretty boring, really. We went for an ice cream or two, got sick of each other after a few weeks. Does that sound like someone in love? You'd probably say to them, well, maybe that was your first girlfriend or boyfriend, but that doesn't sound like you were really in love. Doesn't sound like someone who had tasted what it's like to fall in love with someone else. In the same way, to know God, to taste the living water which comes from him, is like falling in love. To realize what the cross really means. To know in your heart the infinite love shown by Jesus in his death for you, to be filled with an inexpressible joy in knowing Jesus is calling of you, his saving of you personally, his praying for you now to the Father in heaven. All this is such a profound experience that nobody who had really tasted it could shrug and be apathetic about it. So the call of the preacher, I think, throughout the last 2,000 years, since Jesus went back to heaven, has been this: turn from your broken cisterns back to the spring of living water, Jesus Christ. In our gospel reading, Jesus offered himself to the Samaritan woman as the spring of living water which will never let you down. He must have been conscious of this verse in Jeremiah as he did so. To drink in the love of Jesus is to be truly alive. It's to know the source of all life. And to know Jesus is the motivation to identify and destroy these idols in our lives. If we don't know this living water, then like the Israelites, we'll shrug and have no reason to worry about them. We'll be inclined to say of those born-again types who keep talking about Jesus, oh, come off it, you old killjoys. Why are you making such a fuss? So let us this morning heed the words of God spoken through Jeremiah. Like the Samaritan woman, let us be wowed anew by the one who loved us so much that he suffered a fate worse than death for us. And let's leave our broken systems and drink from the eternal spring, the cistern that will never let us down, the living water of Jesus Christ. So let's pray now.